My ex-husband related everything back to sex. If we were fighting or he was unhappy, it was because we didn't have enough sex. No other explanation was acceptable. The couples therapist had told me I couldn't expect a man to stay in a sexless marriage, and I needed to put it on the calendar. What she was calling a sexless marriage was once a week. So I did as I was told and gave up my body to a man who hated me but told me he loved me. One time we were having sex, and my husband became enraged that I looked bored, and that was apparently a turnoff for him. Not enough of a turnoff for him to stop, though. He was angry that I looked like I was being raped while I was literally being raped. That was upsetting to his ego. Not for a moment did he think about stopping sexually coercing me being a solution. Heterosexual marriage is the most abusive institution on the planet. The relief of knowing I'll never need to have sex with a man to keep the peace again has made all of the difficulties of leaving him worth it. Hi, I'm Zahn Valines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about heterosexual relationships as a tool for patriarchal oppression. Before we get started, I have a couple of super quick administrative reminders. First of all, you can find tons of information about my work, about the podcast, and more, as well as details on how to submit a story for the podcast, buy merch, contact me, and all of that good stuff on the Liberating Motherhood website. That's liberatingmotherhood.org. Podcast episodes like the one you're hearing are free, but paid subscribers on Substack and Patreon get an additional podcast episode every month, as well as a bunch of bonus essays, access to the Liberating Motherhood support group, a bunch of stickers, all kinds of stuff. Paid subscribers are also the sole reason I can do this work. I am not beholden to advertisers. I am not beholden to an editor. I am beholden to my readers and listeners, and I like it that way, but I need you guys to keep supporting me. You also, if you become a paid subscriber, help fund scholarships for people who cannot afford to join. So if you like this podcast or my work, or you want to see more, I hope you'll consider becoming a paid subscriber. You can sign up at zahn.substack.com. So we're going to get started with today's amazing guest, who is Jane Ward. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Zahn.
I am so excited to have you on the podcast. I'm going to read your bio and then we'll jump straight into some questions.
Sounds great.
Jane Ward is a professor and chair of feminist studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. She teaches and writes about gender and sexual cultures and has published on topics including the anti-gender movement, online misogyny, the marriage self-help industry, the ebb and flow of interest in lesbian feminism, the meaning of sex between straight-identified men, queer childhood and parenting, the corporatization of gay pride festivals, and the labor of producing gender. Ward is the author of multiple books, including The Tragedy of Heterosexuality, described by the New York Times Book Review as, at heart, a somber, urgent academic examination of the many ways in which opposite-sex coupling can hurt the very individuals who cling to it most. Her book, Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men, was a Lambda Literary Award finalist. She is the co-editor of the first global feminist collection of academic and popular essays about witches and witchcraft, The Witch Studies Reader. Jane is also co-founder of Showing Up for Racial Justice DINA, the Altadena chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice, and a member of the board of the racial justice and mutual aid organization, My Tribe Rise. She is currently working on a book about parenting that blends queer theory with personal narrative titled Raised to Be Free. Jane, I'm so happy to have you here. And I was kind of laughing to myself a little bit when reading your bio because you have written about so many interesting topics that are very relevant to this podcast.
Maybe we're the same person. When I was reading your website, I also had that same thought.
Yeah, I feel like we could do an episode about each of those topics and then probably another one on like each of the subtopics. So maybe someday. For today, I mostly want to stick to the tragedy of heterosexuality, but we may wander into the weeds on lots of other things. So for readers who are not familiar with your work generally or this book specifically, tell me about the tragedy of heterosexuality.
Sure. So, I mean, in a nutshell, this is a book that intervenes in a really common narrative about how it's so it's so difficult to be gay, basically. And I started writing it really at the height of that, of the popularity and the ubiquity of that narrative, because I don't know if you remember the whole It Gets Better campaign, and all of that really relied on this idea that, let's say you have a gay kid, you love them, and maybe you accept their queerness, but maybe you feel worried for their life of discrimination. And that really, really popular narrative never really resonated for me or most of the queer people that I knew, because when we were actually spending time with each other in like a queer space, a safe space, we often just talked about how wildly grateful we were to be queer and how much empathy we felt for the straight people in our lives, how concern we felt for them. And sometimes, I mean, I don't mean to be judgmental, but just like alienation and sometimes pity for the straight people in our lives, especially straight women, because they seemed pretty miserable. And so I just started thinking about, like, what's up with this rhetorical habit that we have of telling a story that, life is so much harder when you're queer and that being straight makes for a happy and easeful life, when there was so much evidence that that's precisely not the case. So that's kind of the question that brought me to the book. And then the book takes off from there.
Well, I love the book. And one of the things that I came away from the book thinking is that maybe our slogan for heterosexuality needs to be, it doesn't get better. Because like it just seems to get worse and worse the longer you're in it. And I feel like one of the things that I see a lot, particularly in liberal spaces among straight or at least straight presenting people, is this idea of like we have to feel for our queer brothers and sisters and we have to support them and it's so hard for them and they're so oppressed and all of that. And I wonder how that actually kind of reinforces heteronormativity by creating this dynamic where we're convinced that heterosexuality is the easy way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. I think they're really interconnected narratives, and that's something that I do argue in the book, that, there are many ways that the tragedy of heterosexuality, especially for straight women, tries to cover itself up. It does that by romanticizing inequality, by romanticizing this notion that, men and women are so opposite. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus, all of that. And that they don't actually want to spend much time talking to each other. They don't really like each other. They want totally different things out of life, and that's totally normal. And what the self-help industry often tells women is that, in fact, that's a recipe for a good marriage, because opposites attract, and that somehow that lack of mutual regard, that lack of interest in each other, is gonna like magically like drive the passion of the relationship. So there's all of that happening. But at the same time, there's also this idea that, well, even if you might have some doubts or questions about your heterosexual marriage, you can always look at queer people and think, well, at least what I have is better than that, because you're going to be celebrated by the broader culture. You're going to, be engaging in something that is perceived to be so utterly natural, so beautiful, something that your whole family is going to, rejoice about that you've done, which is to get married or whatever. And when you're a queer person, there's a good chance that you won't get all of that affirmation. And so I absolutely think it's one of the ways, it's one of the crumbs, basically, that we give to straight women in particular, to keep them in heterosexual relationships is all of that celebration of what's ostensibly normal and natural and beautiful about heterosexuality.
Yeah, I'm also seeing more and more. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's becoming more visible. I'm just noticing it more. How we have this idea that romantic love is like the safest love. It's the most reliable love. If you really want to have someone to take care of you when you're old, then you need to get involved in a romantic relationship. If you really want someone to be with you forever, then you need a romantic relationship, and you need a heterosexual romantic relationship, ideally. And it's interesting to me how that contrasts to the reality of these relationships are really like prisons for a lot of women, and pretty much guarantee a lifetime not only of loneliness, but separation from any other kind of meaningful relationship.
Yes, and thankfully, I really am seeing a lot of pushback right now against that. I mean, I think it's happening at two different generational levels that I can see. I mean, maybe it's even more multifaceted than this, but for women who are like millennials, Gen Z, or sorry, Gen X, which is my age, a lot of women get divorced at that age, and as we know, women initiate the vast majority of divorces. And I work with, in a like a coaching capacity, some of these women who get out of the marriage that they thought was going to provide them with all of that safety, and realize that they actually are in a worse position than they would have been had they not married at all. Because now they're trying to negotiate a what's often a really economically frightening situation of having to like maybe buy their husband out of, half the house, of negotiating joint custody, all of this stuff. And it causes women a lot of stress and a lot of soul searching. And so I've seen that happening for women in their 40s and 50s in particular. But then for women in their 20s, the trends on social media of like heteropessimism, and is it embarrassing to have a boyfriend, and like really a rebellion again, or the 4B movement against heteronormativity. I think we've yet to see, like, what is that actually going to look like? Are these women who are not going to marry because they realize precisely what you just said, that this is an unfulfilled promise that women have been given?
Yeah, so I have a question about the 20 somethings because they don't read my work for the most part. I wish they did because I feel like that's the group who most needs to hear what awaits. And I guess I worry about this kind of burning out for them because I feel like it did for my generation. So I'm 40. And, I remember when I was in my 20s, all of the older people talking about how, we were all loose women who were never going to marry and we weren't committed to anything. And most of us did. And, most of my friends ended up in really horrible situations. And I feel like a big part of the reason that happened is this like separation between generations, this, like stigmatizing of mothers as irrelevant and uncool and people not to listen to. So, you get to like 28 or 29 and you think, well, I'm different from the women who came before me, so it'll just somehow be different for me. And I'm not even really sure if I have a question rolled up in there. I would just like your thoughts on that. Is that, do you think that's happening or likely to happen?
I mean, I think two contradictory things. On the one hand, hope springs eternals on. Like it's hard to live life as a human with no hope that things are going to be different for your generation. It's kind of what I think drives us forward. But at the same time, I mean, I spend all my time in classrooms teaching 18 to 21-year-olds, and then I also work with graduate students, so they're, in their later 20s. And what I'm seeing is that they know exactly what's up, and they know, if only from following all of the feminist content on TikTok, for instance, that relationships with men often require you to, require women to contort themselves to please men. They know that young men in particular have doubled down on patriarchy, that we've seen a retrenchment or like a return to certain kinds of just like totally naked expressions of misogyny. And this got played out in the way that young men voted for Trump in the last election. I think they're tracking the news about how their generation is the first generation in a long time, in decades and decades, to see such a big gender gap between young men and young women in the way that they respond to polling about like basic social issues. Young men are much less likely, like Gen Z men are much less likely to support feminism than millennial, Gen X, and even boomer men. So
Wow.
they're really they're confronted with it. And so I think we see, we see two strategy, or I mean probably, endless kinds of strategies for navigating all of that, but maybe two ends of the continuum are the, the women who have picked up on this kind of women's strike mentality, which, 4Bs, which starts in South Korea, but then kind of spreads around the globe, and a lot of American women have young women on TikTok are claiming themselves as part of 4B, which, if there are listeners who don't know what that is, this is like a kind of pot, like a stance of refusal to date men, to have sex with men, to marry men, or to have children with men. So we this might be like one end of that of the of how to navigate the rise in patriarchal values among young men, and with the other end being like trad wives, basically, that's certainly another strategy, which is like, okay, I'm looking at the writing on the wall here. How am I going to fit myself into this? Well, one thing I could do is just like reinvest in that same kind of formula.
Yeah, it's all just it's so scary. I think like 5 or 10 years ago, probably more like 10 before the rise of Trump, I would tell people that millennial men were the worst men ever because they could like weaponize this faux sensitivity, faux feminism thing and not carry any of the traditional burdens of masculinity and not take on any new burdens. So they just like weren't doing anything at all in their relationships. And I am not heartened to hear that the next generation of men may be even worse.
I
What are
know these kinds of things. Oh, sorry to interrupt
Oh
you,
no,
but
go ahead, go ahead.
I'm just thinking about how things have become so bleak in so many ways that it makes us kind of nostalgic for things that we used to be very critical of. And so, like the new age guy, the performative male, at some point, I had even thought I was going to write a book a few years ago called Woke Bros, and it was going to be, a critique of the current iteration of the sensitive man, and precisely what you said, how, structurally he wasn't actually doing anything much different. It was more kind of performative or symbolic. But now I'm a little like, well, at least those guys are not, at least it's easier to listen to them than to listen to these younger men, you know. At least these are men who are not actively engaged in the manosphere, you know. They're not incels. They're not like the most wretched of versions of masculinity. And so, yeah, it really shifts for me anyway, my sense of what, you know, what's possible for men at this time.
Yeah, it's really, I don't have a lot of empathy for men generally. But I do like to sometimes pause and reflect on kind of how bad they've become and how sad that also is for them that they're living lives that are, just horror shows and kind of devoid of meaning and leaving behind legacies that are nothing but suffering and just it's easy to just fall into this weird existential discussion of like, what even is life and what even is a life and what are these men? It's just all very dark.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I 100% agree with you, and I think it's actually important, I would say even necessary, for us to really get into, you know, what is the emotional damage, the trauma over, and you know, I'm not just talking about in an individual man's life, but over centuries of patriarchy. What damage has that caused to men themselves? And you know, I'm a firm believer that in any system of supremacy and violence, whether that be white supremacy or, you know, patriarchy, that system certainly dehumanizes the people who are its targets, but it also dehumanizes in a particularly entrenched way, and often an invisible, a less visible way. It dehumanizes the people who stand to benefit from that system. And so you know, that was something that was in many ways kind of at the heart of the book I wrote before Tragedy of Heterosexuality, Not Gay, because that was grappling with, you know, straight white men. Yeah, I agree completely.
So this not gay thing, I feel like this is something I think about a lot and I ask people about a lot and no one ever gives me a satisfactory answer. But maybe I've reached the end of the video game of seeking answers and have found the final boss who is you, because I think you might be the one to answer this question for me.
Oh, no
But no
pressure.
pressure. Okay, so the gay not gay stuff with
Yeah.
heterosexual men. And then also the fact that heterosexual men don't really seem to actually like women. Like my social
Right.
media feeds are just filled with men saying horrible things, not about specific women, but about women generally.
Right.
What is going on here?
Yeah. I mean, in gender and sexuality studies, we often, you know, draw a distinction between homosexuality and homosociality. And homosociality is basically, you know, the way that we are socialized to look to people of our same gender for, affirmation, for respect, for validation, for mirroring, this kind of thing. And what's really interesting about, you know, the way the gender binary and patriarchy intersect with homosociality is that, you know, under patriarchy, all of us, men and women, girls and boys, non-binary people and trans people, are encouraged to think, to see ourselves through the eyes of men, straight men, particularly straight white men, because they are who is presented to us as, you know, the authoritative, rational human beings of the world. And so what that means is that women turn to men for validation. Many women have internalized the idea that men are ultimately the experts. They're ultimately the ones in charge. They're ultimately the ones who are going to save us all. You know, they are the great thinkers. They are the great scientists. They are the great artists. And also, men believe that as well. And what you can see is that when we talk about male homosociality, is that even for heterosexual men who ostensibly like and love women, and I believe a lot of them do, ultimately who they turn to for, you know, to seek respect, to, you know, receive validation out in the world, who they want to listen to, whose voices they want to hear, whose leadership they want to follow, that's men. And so it's pretty, once you kind of tune into this, you can see that even for straight men, again, who, you know, might spend an individual straight man might spend most of his time, you know, with his wife or with his girlfriend, and he, you know, gets a lot of things from her, a lot of caretaking from her, a lot of emotional support from her, that even that man mostly, you know, at the end of the day, cares less about what she thinks about the world, about, you know, what we should do as a society, and cares more about what men think. And that's kind of the crux of it. It's like women get triangulated in. You can see this around, you know, especially young straight men and their sexuality. It's like they want to fuck a lot of women, but in part it's to impress other men. And so a lot of us in queer studies have written about the way that men, straight men's sexuality, you know, we're told that it's directed at women, but in many ways the energy of it is actually directed at other men because it's for men. It's about women, but it's for other men.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. One of the weirdest areas where I see this, and I see this constantly when men email me to correct me, is
Yeah.
in the world of men giving relationship and sex advice to other men. And
Yeah.
often like talking over women to do it. You know, we all know the kind of advice that men give other men, and it's, you know, it's mostly not what women want. And you know, but they talk about us like we haven't yet learned how to talk. And I just roll my eyes at these men listening to other men about what women want. But I think what men really want is like a performance for other men rather than anything specific in their relationships with women.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And one of the things, there's a chapter in Tragedy of Heterosexuality that is about these like dating coaches for men. And I did field work. I sat in on, you know, what started out as like the pickup artist industry and their boot camps and stuff, and then turned into, they kind of rebranded themselves as just like relationship coaches. And now, one of the things that's really clear from researching that whole industry is that men really want a kind of gamified, formulaic way to seduce women. And that's what that industry provides them. Like, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to, you know, touch her 2 times in this way, and that's going to lay the groundwork for her. You know, that's going to move you out of the friend zone and into the beginning of a sexual relationship. And the reason that we know this is because we have this research on kinesthesiology, and sometimes they'd even bring in like psyop stuff from the military. Like, if you look at a woman this way, you know, with your, this kind of eye contact is guaranteed to like get her to want to have sex with you. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I sat in these trainings where it's basically this like 5 surefire steps to move a woman from the bar into your bed that night, you know, this kind of thing. So absolutely, like this is one of the features of the like authoritative, male-led self-help industry. And it's actually part of why I'm writing this parenting book that I'm writing right now, because when I got pregnant in 2009, I was part of, what then we called attachment parenting. Now people call like gentle parenting or progressive parenting or whatever. And all of the books that that the other mothers, because of course the fathers were not really involved in this conversation at all, but all of the books that these women were recommending were written by men. And I was like, what? Why are we reading these books written by men when we know? In fact, I just was doing some research on this the other day, and the population, I mean, you can guess on which gender and racial group do you think spends the least amount of time parenting of all groups?
Oh, gee, I have no idea. I could never possibly guess that. We're post-gender and post-race.
Exactly. So it's just amazing when we have the empirical evidence that it's white men who do the least, put in the least number of hours of parenting of all human beings. And yet they are often dominating the, parenting shelf of the bookstore. And it's just, you just kind of got to laugh. And some of these books that I was reading were written by, I mean, the other thing that I noticed in just kind of analyzing the parenting book section is of the library is that the books written by men were often written from their perspective as like expert psychologists, and the books written by women were often written from the perspective of their experience as mothers. And the books in which those authoritative male psychologists would mention their own parenting sometimes would make really clear that they didn't do much parenting at all. I remember one of them that I read, the male writer, I'm trying to remember which book this was, and I can't recall, but the author of the book said, I'm often down working in my study, and my wife knows that how important it is for me to connect with our child. And so when something comes up, I always keep my study door open so that my child could come in and, and let me know what's going on, and basically painted the picture of just like, upstairs, the wife is doing all, the parenting. She's like making all the food, she's doing the cleaning. And occasionally, when the kid wants to come in and for a chat, we'll go down and sit in the dad's like de study and get a little 10 minutes of dad time or something. And this was presented like, he was really proud that he was available to his kid in this way. So the just the like drudgery of parenting, we all know, the routine, invisible daily work of parenting, still is disproportionately done by women. And the COVID pandemic made this all the clearer. And so, yeah, so I'm really excited to be writing a parenting book that really comes out of my experience in the trenches.
I'm so excited to read it. So I have to tell you this story. I think you'll really appreciate this. I think you and I were probably in the same parenting circles. Like I went hard on like attachment parenting and natural birth and breastfeeding and like all of that. And I have to add the caveat that like there are lots of good ways to be a good parent. That was just the one that was most consistent with my values. So I'm not casting judgment on people who parented differently. But so when I was pregnant with my first, my husband and I have a truly egalitarian marriage, and we knew that like we had to be very careful about how we handled parenting. And so, we read all the books together and took all the classes together, and we got really interested in the Bradley method of childbirth, which is husband-coached childbirth, which sounded great to me. I had this vision of like, he's going to be my support person and my advocate and catch the baby and all of that. And he did end up doing all of that. But that's not really like what the guide was about. Really, Bradley birth was about like positioning the man as an authority over the woman's birth and kind of like giving him credit for it. So we signed up for this Bradley birth class, and it was taught by a husband and wife. And I wanted to die within 10 minutes of being at the class, but I'm like, I'm here to learn. I'm going to behave myself and try to learn. And then at some point, the couple was talking about their birth. And the man said the words that will echo in my brain, I think, until my dying day, which were, "We had a minor tear, but it
Oh
didn't
my
hurt too much."
God. Oh my God.
And
It's like
that's when,
Portlandia episode,
right?
like
And
driving.
I mean, my husband and I just looked at each other and we both just started packing up our bags and leaving.
My God. And
And
amazing about that is I feel like that man probably thought that that was like a feminist thing to say, like he was, owning that birthing and parenting are something that, men should be involved with. And, sometimes it's like, Jesus, I feel like some men are just kind of, they're so at a loss for how to genuinely, authentically reflect on what does the situation call for, that they just kind of default to the script. And that's where they get in trouble.
Well, and it's like fake equality. I've started writing and then abandoned many times a piece about how kind of fake gender neutrality and fake gender equality conceals the reality. And it just makes me nuts that we talk about how parents are drowning and parents are struggling and parenthood is so hard when like we all know it's mothers. We all know it's not fathers who are struggling and drowning. And I see it even like at my own child's school, where it's the sort of progressive school where everybody has to volunteer and participate. What that actually means is that every family has to volunteer and participate. What does that mean? It means the women. So we have parent committees and room parents and parent volunteers. And that's what we call them rather than calling them what they actually are, which are mothers' committees and mother volunteers and room mothers. And so it just totally glosses over the fact that there is at this school an extra demand on mothers' time that doesn't really exist for fathers because mothers are going to do the volunteering that the family is required to do.
Oh, you got to write this. That's in New York Times op-ed.
Maybe. I don't know. Well, people get their backs against the wall when you want to use gendered language because we've like internalized this idea that the way we achieve equality is, I guess, by pretending we already have it.
Yeah, I don't know. I
It's
mean,
dark. It's all just so
the great
wild.
thing in situations like that is that we just, we have so much empirical research showing that what you're saying is just the facts, and it's never useful to ignore reality.
Yeah, no, I agree. All right, so I want to talk to you about your parenting book a little bit. I'm going to tell you what I'm seeing and you tell me what you think. My impression of parenting for the overwhelming majority of heterosexual parents is that it's basically the woman doing all of the hard work, the research, the heavy lifting, the emotional regulation, and parenting is more demanding now than ever. And then it's the job of the father to criticize her, undermine her parenting, parent by impulse, and then weaponize the children against her if he can. Is that what's happening?
Wow. Well, it's certainly happening in many marriages. I don't know, what I've been thinking about, because some of the best and most current research on the gender division of labor, like to, household labor and parenting labor, comes from the COVID years. And, one of the things that we saw there was a perfect test of something that the sociologist Kathleen Gerson had argued in 2004. She did this amazing study in which she interviewed men and women about their values regarding, equality in marriages with regard to like parenting and housework. And what she found was that men and women had at that time in 2004 converged in their values more than they ever had before. That men were the majority of men, like the majority of women, reported that they thought those things should be done equally. And when it was only when she got to one very crucial question that men and women diverged, which is she asked them, if something happened where in which, you were not able for some kind of structural reason to divide things equally, what would you do then? And the women reported, well, then I'd rather be single, or, like if I can't actually achieve this vision of equity, then I think I'd probably reevaluate whether I wanted to get married or whether I wanted to have children. And the men said, well, if it's difficult to do things equally, if that proves to be impossible, then I would want to just default to a traditional scenario where I'm the breadwinner and, my wife stays home. And so what Gerson said is that, the more structural supports we have in place, the easier it is for us to both achieve equality, but also achieve the appearance of equality. But if something happens, if there's some event that makes it difficult to support families to achieve equity, then men are perfectly happy to resort to a sexist arrangement. And that, so let's fast forward then to 2019. And the pandemic really was the perfect test of this because many very, liberal men who had been in marriages that they perceived as equal, when the school shut down, when childcare was no longer available, when they spent one day at home trying to work while raising their children, many, many of these men just declared they couldn't do it, and the New York Times ran so many excellent, they just had great reporting on this of how men basically left the house to go work somewhere else on Zoom. They returned to work sooner, and it was women who did the lion's share of working full time, often in a closet so that they could get away from their kids who were screaming on the other side of the door while also trying to homeschool the children. And so for those of us who had remembered Kathleen Gerson's study, it was just couldn't have been clearer that, this was the circumstance in which men felt entitled to bail, or to prioritize their own needs. So I guess what I'm saying in response to your question is, I hope it's not as bleak as what you described, that, men feel their job is to, criticize women and abandon women in the work of the household, though I believe that is probably happening quite often. But even the, on the happier side of things, what we saw is that men who really claimed to care about equity only care about it to the extent that it's easeful. And I think that's really, something we haven't fully grappled with, or it's at least we haven't held men accountable to that.
Well, and I think one thing that we don't talk often enough about is that we want to make equity appealing to men. And so we tell them things like, you don't have to give anything up and it'll make your life better and all of that. And, I do believe that equity makes everyone's lives better, but it actually does require men to give up quite a lot, sort of by definition, because otherwise you're just foisting extra labor on women. And
Yes.
I think what I see a lot with men is this idea that, like, well, equality is great as long as I don't have to do anything or give anything up. And that's not really what equality requires, because sort of our foundational belief here is that men have taken more than their fair share and created this system to, like, reinforce that. So, for the majority of marriages, it is going to hit a point where equity is hard or too hard. I think for most of them, it's when the kids appear.
Yes, 100%. And I think we see that too, kind of playing out at the political level with this backlash, this kind of like anti-woke, so-called anti-woke backlash, where, many men have said, look, wokeness went too far. Like, now you're trying to get me to accept trans people. And now you're trying to get me to, be accountable for the fact that I sexually harass someone. Just
How very dare we?
all the things they think went too far. And it's like, well, saying things went too far is one way to describe it, but another way to describe it is that, people who hoard power get upset when people who have been mistreated and harmed by their power hoarding would like that power distributed equally. And so we're constantly, in this position of trying to pretend that justice doesn't mean that men give anything up. And I think you're absolutely right. It does require giving things up. It does require making, being willing to share the power that you've been keeping for yourself.
So you have this whole section in The Tragedy of Heterosexuality where you talk about kind of the normalization of the idea of marital hatred. And women email me all the time and they are, with basically questions about, well, is it normal for us to hate each other sometimes? And often, like, baked into that question is, like, am I crazy for wanting better? And I'm starting to see now, lots of instructions to women and to young women, especially, that we need to lower our standards and that we need to accept that, being married means some level of unhappiness and maybe a chronic level of unhappiness. They never say why we have to accept that, but it seems obvious that the reason is so that, like, women can continue to serve men as woman appliances. So, talk to me about this, like, normalization of marital hatred and what that's about.
I mean, the first thing I want to say about that is that it's one of the main things, probably the first thing that queer people notice and worry about straight marriages. There's just, like, this is where the whole are the straights okay? Do they even like each other comes from, because it does appear that many married straight people really loathe their partner. And this is not to say, I've gotten so much criticism from straight people saying, in response to Tragedy of Heterosexuality, saying, are you trying to say queer people are perfect? No, I'm not saying queer people are perfect. Of course, we also divorce, but frankly, and there's dysfunction in queer relationships, but frankly, the fact that queer people divorce, and I think the last the data that I saw recently suggested that queer people might be divorcing at a higher rate than straight people. And as far as I'm concerned, it just make proves my point, which is that queer people are less like inclined to romanticize misery, and so more likely to get out of a relationship that feels toxic. So, I, you know, not to just to overdo this or to beat a dead horse, but there's just so much, not just romanticizing heterosexual misery that happens in popular culture, but eroticizing it even, you know, the sort of the slap and the kiss, the like the big argument where, you know, the man and the woman, there's been some major betrayal. They clearly hate each other. You know, they're right in the middle of, a major fallout where one has said something deeply offensive to the other, and then next thing you know, they're having sex, you know, this kind of thing. And so it's like that kind of stuff, but it's also what we tell little girls, like, oh, you know, he hit you or he teased you because he likes you. It's just baked into straight culture, which is that, you know, heterosexuality derives on conflict, is, you know, or heterosexual romance is somehow animated by or intensified by conflict. And it's really dysfunctional. And it's just, you know, it's so plainly dysfunctional and neurotic. To invest in that narrative, it actually creates so much suffering for people, and yet it's hard to counteract it because it's so baked into, you know, all of the movies we watch and everything. So I think, you know, the question when women ask, is it normal for us to hate each other, is both yes and no. You know, normal as in common, yes. Normal as in the way it should be, no. And we know it doesn't have to be that way because it's not how queer people have relationships. And I spent a good amount of time in Tragedy of Heterosexuality talking about lesbian feminist relationships in particular, where there's an understanding that, you know, when you desire other women, like when you're sexually attracted to women, it's inseparable from feminism. It's inseparable from wanting what's best for women. It's inseparable from respecting women as a group, you know, of people, and wanting them to have freedom and caring about what women think and wanting to follow women's leadership. That's all sort of part of what makes women hot for lesbians. And that's why lesbians are, you know, we're notoriously attracted to strong women, powerful women, because who wouldn't want that, you know? And so to my mind, it's a telltale sign right off the bat that straight men are often attracted to women who've been disempowered in some way, who are much younger than they are, who appear to not have any agency, you know, for decades was like, you know, the bombshell woman. The sexiest woman was portrayed as a stupid woman, as a woman who could hardly had anything to say, who spoke with a high-pitched, squeaky voice. You know, often all you have to do too is look at the way that supermodels are posed in print media, often in this kind of weird, fallen down, unnatural, looking away from the camera. You know, just a lot of what men are told makes a woman attractive is precisely her passivity, her weakness, her ability to be controlled. And that's just not true for lesbians. And so there's something deeply distorted in straight culture that, you know, keeps this going.
I'm listening to you talk about this, and it's actually helping me understand some of my interactions with readers, because I have first of all, I'm queer in a heterosexual presenting relationship, which I do think plays a role in why I was able to have an egalitarian relationship.
Oh, yes.
But also, there's been this weird dynamic as I have become more public and as people kind of learn, like, oh, she's a woman married to a man who's like not terrible to her. Where a lot of readers become very interested in my relationship. And when I talk to people, often they will say things to me like, oh, but I bet you guys have some really intense fights, don't you? And there's like an air of excitement that they like want to hear me say yes. And like the answer is no. Like we're actually not screaming at each other. And I did this survey a while ago because I was going to write about like what women seek in their relationships with men, and I ended up not doing it. And one of the things I asked women was like, what were the three characteristics that attracted you to your current partner? And then when I was analyzing the data, I did like a word cloud that showed the things that appeared most often. And it was words like dominance, controlling, intense, alpha. And yeah, that's it's really dark. But I do think that that gets romanticized, even like when we're in a feminist context talking about a feminist relationship. I think people want to hear, oh, but he's really challenging you behind the scenes about all this. And like that sounds like romantic to people.
I mean, I don't know what to say about that really when women want dominance, then, I want them to have that. But because I want women to have what they want. But also, if that's what you want, then that's what you're going to get. And you may find that actually it's not what's making you happy. I think queerness helps provide some nuance to this because it's a space where, kink and the kinds of conversations that people have in queer spaces and kink spaces about power allows you to separate out, like, well, when you say dominance, do you actually mean like that he controls whether you have access to money and that it has the entitlement to say that he doesn't want anything to do with washing his own dishes. Like, is that actually what you mean? Or did you mean, that he's dominant in bed or that he has a kind of masculinity that, really works for you? Because those in straight culture just get sort of all conflated, like all smushed into one. But they don't have to be at all. And, I'm attracted, I've only ever been attracted to masculine women. And my partner is masculine, and we've been together for 20 years now. And I would say there's certain ways that I like her to be dominant, but it's very narrow. I'm mostly like emotionally and psychologically and logistically, I am the top in our marriage. And so these are the kinds of things that you can just negotiate. But again, you really have to queer your heterosexuality a little bit to do that.
Well, we haven't normalized any of these negotiations in heterosexuality. I find that people think that if you don't just fall naturally into it, that it's not romantic. So, you can't have discussions about what you want sexually. You can't have discussions about like how you're going to resolve conflict. It should all just happen like through the magic of romantic love, I guess.
Well, one of the things I am writing about in the parenting book is contracts and how much I love them and how
Oh,
hot
I love
I think
that.
they are.
So we have like a parenting and relationship and sex and all of that contract. And I tell people that and they're horrified. And I just love their horror.
I mean, nothing could be hotter for me anyway, I think, than to have that. And of course, it can be renegotiated and everything, but I mean, I don't get why people are horrified by that or why they think that's not romantic, because if anything, it's sort of sitting down and naming, like, use your big girl and your big boy voice, and name what you want. Like, that's pretty hot. And so, and especially when women are able, when straight women are able to say what they actually want out of parenting. And I have a friend who has a parenting contract that was one of the most feminist, deliciously feminist documents I have ever read in my life. She, you know, her husband wanted to have a kid, and she was somewhere between not wanting to have a kid and wanting to be maybe just sort of less involved in the parenting than he did. And so before, it's really important to make the contract before you actually have the kid.
Yes.
This got spelled out that basically she was like, I do not want to be the primary parent. I'm the sort of secondary parent, and I want a room of my own that the kid never goes into. I want these X nights away from the house. I'm not going to do any of the middle of the night parenting. I mean, it is so, it's to read it written by a woman, it's like so bold, so striking.
Yeah.
And yet it's just saying, I would like to have the thing that millions of men have had without having to even ask for it. You know, I basically want to be the dad, is what it's saying. And for a woman to own that, you know, it's not only that, it's like surprising that she would ask that of a male partner. It's also that it challenges our very understanding of womanhood, because, you know, womanhood itself, and certainly the intersection of womanhood and parenting, is supposed to be about like a natural maternal instinct and a desire to nurture. And so when women recognize, like, I actually don't want to do all that, I think that's really threatening to a lot of people, because it threatens the gender binary. And so I'm really excited about women getting to say, like, actually, I want to be a dad
Yeah.
in all ways that that has been understood culturally and historically.
Well, and even still, like women saying it before the child is there gives their partner a chance to consent or not. And so it's still like not really being a dad. Like it's still like a better deal for the man than women have historically gotten. But I love that for her. That's wonderful. Okay, so you're talking about contracts in your parenting book. Tell me what else is in this book. I'm so excited for it to come out. I'm so upset that it's so far away.
Yeah. Well, it's due to me. It's due to my editor February 1st, so I'm frantically finishing it up. Yeah, so this is a book about it's called Race to Be Free, A Queer Approach to Parenting. And I really wanted to write a book that was about how everyone can parent queerly, because this is a book about how to take some of the insights that come out of queer and trans thinking and activism, and the way that queer and trans people have understood children, have understood the adult-child relationship, have raised children ourselves, and just to show that these are all really powerful and beautiful models for how to be with children, how to nurture children, but there's nothing about them that requires you to actually be queer identified. It's a methodology. It's a queer method for raising children. And so that's what the book is. And I'm hoping that it's something that people can, you know, all people can take up, even people who aren't parents, who don't identify as parents, but who work with children a lot, or who are close to children, you know, their nibblings in their lives. And so it centers around a lot around, like, what does it mean to be in relationship with children in a way that truly provides them gender self-determination. What does it mean to be in relationship with children in a way that does not sexualize or heterosexualize them? What does it mean to be, what does it look like to be in relationship with children in a way that isn't about hoping they will reproduce you and your choices, or that they'll somehow provide a return on your investment with their future success, whatever that looks like for you, but rather to be fully and 100% present in relationship with children as they are right now. What does it look like to parent deeply feministly, to role model that for children? What does it look like to parent children collectively and to bring children into the movement for gender justice? So it's really kind of taking, it's operating on two levels, sort of thinking broadly about all of those things, especially in a moment of return to authoritarian parenting. But it's also got just a lot of practical tips about parenting in the day-to-day based on those values.
I love it all. I love every word you've just said. I just can't wait for it to be out. I also love it that you mentioned the return to authoritarian parenting, because this is not something I'm hearing people talk about so much, but it's definitely something I'm seeing.
I mean, whew.
It's like kids are too soft and, all this, like they're emotionally tending to children is stunting them, and you're a helicopter parent. And there's also this other like thing where there's pushback against like physical safety, like you're a loser if you want to put the car seat in right, sort of thing. It's just really, it's a weird time to be a parent.
Well, I think that parenting always, it's a relationship with a child, with children. It's a job. It's a kind of labor, but it also is a cultural experience, and it always is shaped by the ethos of the time, the debates about how to live and what it means to be a person and what it means to be a man and a woman, and so the fact that we're seeing the rise of fascist authoritarianism in the United States and around the world, we could expect then that that's going to show up in the way that people are thinking about parenting. And there's a lot of evidence that it is, with these, I think the last count is over 70 parents' rights bills that have been introduced across the country that are about parents trying to claim full power over children's,
God.
what children are learning in school, what the kinds of people and ideas that children have access to. And there's just a like a whole moral panic and really a lot of it based on just these totally absurd urban legends about how, you might drop your kid off at school and their principal's going to take them to get a sex change operation and just stuff that, or children using litter box. I mean, the panic right now around children and the way that the Republican Party has invested truly millions and millions and millions of dollars in these attack ads that are about children and gender. It kind of, I think, tells us everything we need to know about people's anxieties about the next generation, and specifically their anxieties about Gen Z and Gen Alpha, because at the same time, I mentioned that we've seen this backlash among young men, and that is true. But when you look at the characteristics, the generational research on Gen Z, it's like core characteristics overall, especially driven by, young women and non-binary and trans members of that generation. There's overwhelming support among Gen Z for queer rights, for trans rights. A lot of, Gen Z is the first generation where, there's just a lot of emphasis on gender fluidity, gender freedom, a lot of emphasis on being able to claim your needs, whether around neurodivergence or disability or mental health. Gen Z is very open in talking about mental health. And these are things that are deeply threatening to, the powers that be. So I think one of the ways that the right tries to control social change is by cracking down on children. And we saw that with, historically, that's borne itself out with the way the Nazi Party like created Hitler Youth and all of this stuff. And so, of course, we're going to see a lot of focus on like, let's go back to toughening up children, returning to hitting children, enough already with kids talking about their mental health. It's they just need good old-fashioned discipline, this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a wild ride as a parent, but I think your book will be a helpful antidote and the sort of thing that a lot of us are really looking for. So thank you for writing it, and just thank you for being you in the world and just making it better to the greatest possible extent. Listeners, I will put all of Jane's information in the show notes, including book information and all of that. And Jane, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing.
Thank you, Zahn. I love talking to you.
And thank you to everyone for listening.